This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao, in for Frank Stacio. No sex until marriage was the name of the sex ed game in North Carolina for a long time. 10 years ago, the state passed a law promising students more information. The Healthy Youth Act requires public middle and high schools to use scientific facts and include contraception. So why do abstinence-only curriculums remain the status quo at many schools? It might be because there are so many stakeholders at the table when it comes to sex ed. Parents, districts, and advocacy groups all vie for control over textbooks and instruction. This is one of many topics we're going to talk about today as we explore sex ed in North Carolina. It's part of a new series we're launching called Embodied, Conversations about Sex, Relationships, and Your Health. My first guest is Julia Considine. She's a health educator who's done research about how schools are implementing the Healthy Youth Act. Julia, welcome.
Thanks so much, Anita. Thanks for having me.
And we'd like to warn listeners that, as we said, today's show does explore sex and sex education in North Carolina. So if you have kids with you, feel free to download our podcast or check in later at thestateofthings.org. Julia, give us a brief history of sex ed in North Carolina. I outlined a few key transition points at the beginning, but remind us where we're coming from.
Absolutely. So really the first mention of sex education in North Carolina schools was in about 1996. And the General Assembly, they passed this bill, Teach Abstinence Until Marriage. And so it said that abstinence from sexual activity outside of marriage is the expected standard for all school-age children. And outlined a lot of other pieces as well. And so then in the years following, researchers were curious if abstinence-only education was effective at reducing sexual activity, reducing teen pregnancy rates, and reducing rates of sexually transmitted infections. And what researchers found consistently was that abstinence-only education is not effective at reducing rates of teen pregnancy. It does not reduce rates of teens engaging in vaginal intercourse. They also found that oftentimes it was including inaccurate information about contraception, and it was failing to require the use of scientifically accurate information.
So things changed in 2009. We passed this Healthy Youth Act. What changed?
So for that, the Gilling School of Global Public Health, they did an independent study of both conservative and liberal parents. And this was important. And what they found was that 92% of parents in North Carolina, they wanted sex ed to be taught in schools. And of those, nearly all of them, 99.6%, they wanted that their child to be taught about the transmission and prevention of STIs. And they wanted instruction to also include the effectiveness and failure rates of birth control, including condoms. And so all of these things coming together, parents being concerned about the high rates of teen pregnancy and STIs, they saw the need for more comprehensive sex ed policy. And so, as you said, the Healthy Youth Act was passed in 2009 and gave schools guidance on more specific guidance on what they should be teaching in schools.
And so when we say sex ed, I want you to clarify here, it's more than just explaining what sex is to kids. We're talking about comprehensive sex education, which actually includes a number of other components. What is comprehensive sex ed? We hear that term thrown around a lot.
Absolutely. And I also teach in elementary and middle schools. And this is so important because I think there's a lot of fear around what is sex ed. And so it's really important for people to understand what it is. And so we're teaching that abstinence is the safest and expected standard for all age children. And we're teaching about healthy relationships, how to have a healthy relationship with yourself and with other people, having a healthy relationship with your body, practicing decision-making skills, practicing refusal skills if you're in a situation where there's peer pressure. We're also talking about consent and practicing having examples of consent and unending bodily autonomy, how to avoid negative health consequences. And in the middle schools and high schools, their understanding about FDA-approved methods of contraception, and also about how to communicate about sexuality and sexual health. And these are such important lessons for young people to hear. And as I just, most parents, liberal and conservative across the state, they want their students, their children to get this information because there's a lot of other sources or opportunities throughout the lifespan for young people to get this information from a trained individual that's medically accurate information.
So we have this Healthy Youth Act passed in 2009. It says it's state law to teach comprehensive sex education. You did some research and looked at what exactly was happening in schools around the state, how this was being implemented. What did you find?
So yeah, we wanted to know, we have this great policy coming out of Raleigh, and how is that being translated throughout the state? And so what we saw was there were a lot of barriers to this information being able to reach the teachers, the administrators, and the teachers, and ultimately the students. And funding was a huge piece in that. In looking at, there are some districts across the state that have a healthful living coordinator position. There are many that don't have that position. So it's like you imagine in Raleigh, we have North Carolina Healthy Schools, which is part of the Department of Public Instruction, and they have full information, up-to-date resources, opportunities for professional development for teachers. But then if a district doesn't have someone who knows to reach out to NC Healthy Schools, if they don't have a health coordinator, then they're not accessing that information. And then oftentimes you have many health and PE teachers, 88% of PE teachers had not received a class in college about how to teach about sexuality. So you then have teachers who are and they oftentimes don't feel comfortable with the material.
I want to bring in one guest to join us in our conversation. Elizabeth Finley is the Director of Strategic Communication at Shift NC. Elizabeth, welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So we've been talking with Julia about her surveying work, looking at how the Healthy Youth Act has been implemented around the state of North Carolina. And she discovered that it's been implemented very differently, state to county to county, school to school. Can you help us understand if I'm an individual school, I hear the state mandate of this is what I'm supposed to be teaching, what do I do next, and why is there such a discrepancy?
Right. So our organization, Shift NC, when this law passed, one of the very first things we did was go from school district to school district to help them understand just the basics of the law. Because I think when any education law passes, getting that information about what the new requirements are out to schools is a big task. And so so the first thing we did was help school systems understand the law itself, understand the new requirements. And then what we found is there was this vast need for professional development, which Julia talked about. So in North Carolina, there is no set statewide curriculum. We have the statewide standards. So the law spells out that young people need to learn about abstinence, condoms and contraceptives, some things about healthy relationships and abuse prevention, sex trafficking, in grades 7, 8, and 9. But it is totally up to the local school system to determine how that's taught. And when we've looked at school systems and when we've worked with school systems, we've seen these big variations that Julia talked about, not just from county to county, but also from school to school, and even within schools from classroom to classroom, based again on the things that Julia mentioned. So teacher comfort, availability of resources. Where we've really seen some school systems excel is when they've been really thoughtful about creating a system-wide approach to how to teach sex education. So they've been thoughtful about selecting a curriculum that works for them, about sharing with their teachers what is okay to teach in a school system, especially shifting from an abstinence-only landscape to a more comprehensive landscape, saying these topics are okay to talk about now, and then giving them the professional development they need to do that comfortably.
So, Julia, when you were going and doing this survey, what kinds of curriculums were you seeing? Can you give us a quick sense of the range?
The Department of Public Instruction, they have a flash drive that they send out to different districts, and a lot were using that flash drive. There were also There was a lot of confusion about what to use and where to look, again, because there wasn't often that guidance from Raleigh. So that was something that there was a lot of confusion district to district about what they could use.
And so what we know, the Department of Health and Human Services, as of 2017, said 38% of North Carolina high school students reported having sexual intercourse. So students in high schools are having sex. So from a public health perspective, briefly, Julia, what are the effects of inadequate sex ed in schools?
Well, sex ed ends in ninth grade as well. And less than 20% of ninth graders are having sex. So, and you know, we know how the brain develops every single year. Their brains are developing and they're understanding more and they're understanding risks more. And so for them, not only to have not had that as in elementary or middle school, but when they're not receiving that even further into high school, then you can see the increased rates in STDs across the state. So the status of women in North Carolina just put out a report, and North Carolina women rank seventh highest in AIDS diagnosis rate, eighth highest in chlamydia, and ninth highest in gonorrhea across the country. And so we have a real problem with STDs and young people not understanding. And I had a seventh grader come up to me after I had finished presenting, and he was this tough boy in class. And he came up to me afterwards, and he was really concerned, and he looks at me and he goes, "I didn't know I could get one of those diseases if I let her put her mouth on my, you know."
Wow. Okay. A lot more to talk about. Julia, stay with us. We'll continue this conversation about sex ed in North Carolina today on The State of Things. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. We are talking about sex education today as part of Embodied, our new series on sex, relationships, and your health. Do you have a kid in North Carolina's public schools, or maybe you teach? We want to hear your voice. Tweet us, find us on Facebook, or give us a call, 1-877-962-9862. Still with me is Julia Considine. She is a health educator based in Asheville who did surveying around the state to look at how the state law about sex ed was being implemented. Still with me also is Elizabeth Finley. She is from Shift NC, Sexual Health Initiatives for Teens, the state's largest sexual health nonprofit. So, Julia, we cut you off a little bit, but you were telling us a story about a particular kid concerned about the information that he was getting about STIs. Did you want to finish that story and maybe contextualize his experience?
As an educator in the schools, I see young people really wanting to hear medically accurate information from someone that they can trust, so they understand what's happening to their bodies. So I see, like, there are these two ways that we perceive human sexuality. There's this one, like, that it doesn't exist and we don't want to see it. And there's another one that I hear young people seeing that's like, be sexy, look sexy, act sexy. And nowhere in there are we talking about health and how to understand your body and your anatomy and your physiology, and how to support your body and to cultivate and maintain health now and as a teenager and as an adult. And so I see young people really wanting that, and that's what they deserve with comprehensive sex ed and the funding for it being implemented equitably across the state.
Julia Considine is a health educator based in Asheville. Thank you so much for joining us, Julia.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
So I'm here with Elizabeth Finley. She's the Director of Strategic Communication at Shift NC. And just a reminder to listeners that we are talking today about sex and sex education in North Carolina. So if you have kids with you who you don't want to hear this, feel free to tune in later. So Elizabeth, we talked a bit about the work of Shift NC. We've heard about how schools around the state are implementing the law differently. I'd like to learn a little bit more about parents and their role. In the past couple of years, we have had some vocal concerns from parents who don't like the curriculum that they're seeing in their kids' schools. Last year, there was a sex ed sit-out organized by parents who said this the curriculum was, quote, graphic gender-bending sex education. What concerns are you hearing from parents about the sex ed curriculum in their kids' classrooms?
Yeah, so we tend to hear more often from parents who want to be sure that their kids are getting content, or very often we hear that they assume that they're getting content, they just want it to be high quality. We view parents as an incredibly important component of the work that we do. And so in national surveys of teens asking what are the most influential voices that they hear about sex, about their decisions about sex, about relationships, they always name parents as that most influential voice, ahead of media, ahead of peers. And so for us, thinking about the big picture of how do communities and schools keep young people healthy, like it just wouldn't be strategically sound of us to leave parents out of that equation. So one thing that we do when we launch new initiatives is we do a pretty full-scale needs assessment, and that includes gathering parent input. So we've done surveys both across the state and in local communities, asking parents what they want, and huge majorities want sex education that's essentially comprehensive sex education that includes both abstinence and information about condoms and contraceptives and things about healthy relationships. We've also had the chance to dig in and do focus groups with parents in a lot of communities. And one thing that they talk about is how they, number one, view it as the school's role to teach about some of the facts about sex. So they really want their child learning about this stuff from an expert, somebody who knows how the body works and how STIs work and, you know, what are the different contraceptive methods. Parents don't feel really equipped to talk about those facts. They also know that they need to be talking about sex and they feel really stuck on how to do it. So we've done a few things. We have a parent website called preparedparent.org that's sort of a choose your own adventure to help you navigate conversations about sex. We've also been working to fine-tune a parent training that really helps parents know and understand how the adolescent brain works. So, you know, what is your teen thinking? How do you communicate with them? That helps walk them through some values clarification. So, you know, how do you talk to your child about what you want for them, what you expect of them? If you haven't gotten really solid in that yourself and understand what you feel, what you want them to know, where it's coming from, and then how to communicate that to your child. And that's been really helpful, and the feedback has been really great. But even in that two-hour training, that great skill building on how to talk about sex, they're still expecting the schools to do their part in providing the factual information.
But there is a minority who says, I don't feel comfortable with the content in the sex ed curriculum. And there have been some criticisms of some of the curriculum that Shift NC has used. What are those criticisms and how would you respond?
Yeah, so absolutely. I think a small vocal minority is something that has existed for longer than our organization has existed. And one thing that we have seen increasingly lately is the spread of misinformation on social media. And I think that's not just true of sex education. That's true of a whole host of public health issues and other issues. I think one thing that is really challenging for us is very often those criticisms are centered on misinformation. Now, it is absolutely true that there are some parents who do not want their child to get sex education or do not want them to get anything but abstinence only until marriage education. And North Carolina law gives them the ability to opt their child out of those classes. And we support their ability to opt their child out of those classes. But, you know, so often what we see when we look at the criticisms is they're criticizing something that's a real misrepresentation of a curriculum or of a lesson plan.
Does teaching kids about sex encourage them to have sex?
There's a lot of research on that. And what it shows is that it absolutely does not encourage them to have sex. Young people don't look at sex education in the classroom or conversations about sex from their parents as a tacit endorsement of having sex. In fact, there's a good amount of research that shows that comprehensive sex education helps young people delay sexual initiation until later. later in life. So young people who get comprehensive sex ed wait longer to have sex. And that's in addition to the other benefits like lower teen pregnancy rates, better academic success, and a whole host of other benefits to comprehensive sex ed.
I want to bring in one more guest to the conversation now. This is Jamika Lynch. She is a health educator in the southeastern corner of North Carolina. She's worked with Shift NC and her local community to create lesson plans. Welcome, Jamika.
Hello.
So you were raised in Columbus County, and that is where you work now as a health educator. What was your sex ed like growing up, and how is it different from what you're doing in classrooms?
Quite a bit different. I feel like I am not a Columbus County born. I was raised there, and I like to say that I'm not a native. People in Columbus County like to know, you know, they were born and raised there. That's what's most important. But I think that the most important part is that I did not get sex education in Columbus County schools. And that was something that was taught in the home for me. And I think that things now are very quite different, especially in my role at the health department and now finally into the schools.
So what is your role?
So my role at the health department is a health educator, but specifically I am funded through North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services, specifically with TPHPI, Teenage Pregnancy Prevention Initiative. So my focus is teenage pregnancy prevention. So what I am allowed to do is to teach young people comprehensive sex education with an evidence-based curriculum called Making Proud Choices.
And give us some examples of what this looks like. And if you walk into my classroom, what are you going to say to me? What are you going to teach me?
So I teach in the school. So it's a 14-week module. So I go into the school and we talk about everything from contraceptives, birth control, healthy relationships, consent, condom use, literally from A to Z. And we also often open up with goals. So before we can even start that conversation, where are your values and goals and what that looks like?
So in 2017, I know Black teens in Columbus County had an 85% higher rate of teen pregnancy than their white peers. How do you address these disparities?
I feel like for me, being a person of color, a woman of color, to be able to go out into the community and go into the schools to teach comprehensive sex education, it should be something that all students, but because we cannot necessarily neglect what those disparities are. So I think it's really important to make sure that you have the person that looks like the students that need the information. So that would be me. And I feel like there's not a specific focus, but as long as I'm actually teaching like I'm supposed to and within fidelity of the program, then that's something that all of my students will get, including those persons of color.
I know that you have been working within the community for quite some time, and it has taken a while to build up the relationships that you have now. You've worked with faith communities. What is the reception to your work and your role in those religious spaces?
So very interesting. I worked with faith communities in my earlier years of my teenage pregnancy work. They were who supported me first, surprisingly. I started in community settings before I even got into the schools. That's a new thing. And at first, there was a bunch of pushback. You know, I am proud to be from a very rural Bible Belt town, but it was hard to ignore the numbers and the stats and the young people, because it's not about me. It's not about them. It's about these young people and them getting the information. So once they found out what the curriculum was about and what was I trying to do with these young people, what was I trying to educate them, they opened up their churches and their community centers to me and said, sure, absolutely. So I am definitely indebted to them, because they are the ones that supported me first.
So we talked a bit about teen pregnancy. Elizabeth, I know national numbers, the teen pregnancy rate has been on a downward trend. Is that mirrored in North Carolina? And is there any correlation between changes in sex education and what we're seeing in teen pregnancy rates?
Yeah, so the teen pregnancy rate in North Carolina has dropped about 75% since it peaked in 1990. And that's a huge win for North Carolina. We're really proud of that, and a lot of hard work has gone into that. At the same time, you know, we still see a lot of need. So it's not time to give up on things like sex education, right? So we know that for women under age 25, they're the most likely to say that their pregnancies were unintended if they become pregnant. We know that young people ages 15 to 24 account for half of our gonorrhea cases, 67% of our chlamydia cases, and about a quarter of our new HIV diagnoses. And that across all of those, there are big differences between what we see in rural counties and what we see in young people of color. So there are big disparities there. For us, sex education is a huge priority and need in North Carolina. You cannot take care of your health if you don't understand it. But we also know that it has to be a multi-pronged effort. So we're not just thinking about what schools can do to provide information, but what other places in communities can provide information, what healthcare settings can do to really make their services available and friendly for teens, what different systems in the state, so like the foster care system or juvenile justice system, can do to reach teens in a way that's trauma-informed, that accounts for their different life experiences and needs, and recognizes that they're at higher risk for some of these health outcomes. So I don't think we can make progress without the schools in that mix, but the schools aren't the only piece.
So we reached out to people online and asked them to share their experiences of sex ed in North Carolina, and we got a wide range of stories. One from someone named Zach, who said, "I remember asking a friend what a condom was because I'd always heard the word, and he said, it's to catch the seed. I started nodding my head knowingly, but inside I was thinking, wait, what's the seed?" So there's tons of misinformation. Kids don't know what the terminology is. And Jamika, I wonder, I mean, with the rise of the internet and the expansion of availability to information and to porn online,
sure,
what are you hearing from students now? I mean, the landscape of how they're getting information, it has to be changing so drastically.
Absolutely. So porn is definitely, I would say, number one, as well as their peers. I think that they get a lot of misinformation from family members as well. Because they are taught what their mom or cousin or aunt or grandmother has always told them about something. And definitely porn, online, people sharing stories, that's the society that we live in. But I think what's most important, Elizabeth was saying, is that it's not just the schools, there's these other entities. And that makes sense in Columbus County because I am that person. There is no other sex educator in Columbus County. She talked about pregnancy rates specifically in Columbus County. When I started this work almost 9 years ago, we were ranked 8 thanks to Shift NC's data and their research. And now we are ranked 15. So we've done a 13.2% drop since I've started this work. And I think that that means something, and that says a lot to the schools because they finally let me in the schools in Columbus County. But that took a lot of perseverance and not shutting up about it, to be honest, because it's about education and it's about letting the young people realize what's best for them in their bodies.
Is it inclusive of people of various gender identities, people of various sexual orientations? What does that look like around the state? Maybe both of you can comment on how much inclusivity we're seeing.
So for Columbus County, for me, I do have a safe space and a very inclusive classroom. It is not something that it's necessarily highlighted in the schools, but for me and my safe space, I do. I know I had my very first year at Whiteville High School. I had some students that I immediately validated them because we talked about pronouns and what that looks like and how in my space we are going to respect those things. So I wanted to know everyone's affirming pronoun. And by the end of that class, I had 3 students that come up and say, "Can we call you mom?" So you know, I feel like those are things that need to be talked about. They want me to be a part of their GSA. You know, it's important for them to know that they can be safe in my space while I have them there. And that's really, really important to me. What it looks like throughout the state, I'm sure a lot different.
Yeah, briefly, Elizabeth.
Yeah, this is an area where we see way more variation, even more so than we see in the substance of sex education, because schools are required to have anti-bullying policies that include sexual orientation and gender identity. But that's kind of it. They don't require that sex ed be inclusive of LGBTQ young people. They don't require that schools have a space for them. So we've been working with schools to do, and other settings where youth go, to do training on how to create a safer, more affirming space, because not everybody has a Jamaica. And this is an area where things have changed so much, where we have a much better understanding of the need and how to support young people, and where professional development for educators makes a huge difference, because having that GSA in the school, having adults who are willing to use your pronouns, who can be a safe person for you to go to, just present in the school, is so good for young people's safety, for their mental health outcomes, and is going to help them connect more with the health curriculum.
Absolutely.
Jamaica Lynch is a health educator in Columbus County, North Carolina. Elizabeth Finley is the Director of Strategic Communications at Shift NC. Thank you both.
Thank you so much.
Now, not knowing about sex in your own body can be scary, but it can also be funny. Playwright Lindsay Watkins explores the dangers and humor of ignorance in her new play, O Righteous God and Sinful Me. It's on stage this weekend alongside dozens of other productions as part of the Women's Theater Festival in Raleigh. Lindsay, welcome.
Hi.
And as we've been saying throughout the show, we are talking about sex and sex education today. So if you have kids who you don't want hearing this, feel free to check in later at our podcast, stateofthings.org. Lindsay, what was your experience of sex ed in high school?
Well, I went to a Catholic school, and so my sex education was purely abstinence-based. But, I mean, that goes outside of Catholic school. All sex education in Tennessee is abstinence-based, so there's not really sex education. There's scare tactics, and there's scare tactics.
So what inspired this play? Was it that experience?
Yes, and I also, mainly, when you do eventually get to learn about sex education, it's very catered towards guys and their experience, and I wanted to normalize female sexuality and the fact that girls also get horny and explore themselves, and I wanted to normalize those ideas. I wanted to normalize talking about female genitalia as often as we talk about male genitalia, and I wanted to explore the idea that we admire women or respect them when they are virtuous and modest, and this sexualizing young girls by expecting them to be virtuous and expecting them to also be responsible for keeping men chaste, because they're taught that the sexual awakening is going to happen for their male peers, but they don't know how to handle their own. They just know that they're supposed to be responsible for keeping their male peers in check.
You're referencing purity culture, which is mm-hmm. the experience of people who may get educated in the South learning about sex as a sin. And yes. I think you in your play look at how this can impact kind of the long-term experience you have with your body if you are educated yes. in that way. So let's dive right into it. We're going to get a scene. I'd like to bring in two actors to the conversation now. Joining the conversation are Autumn Hemmelgarn and Haley White. Lindsay, will you set up the scene briefly for us?
Yes. So new girl Evie has just came to the school. This is St. Elizabeth Ann Seton's all-girls Catholic boarding school. And Evie has just been sent here, and she has just moved into her dormitory, and so she's meeting her new peers, and she asks them if she can borrow a tampon, and they explain to her that none of them use tampons because you're not supposed to put anything up there until you and your husband are ready to make a baby. And Evie is just completely mind blown by that idea. And so she asks them if they've never put anything in their vagina, and they have no idea what she's referring to about what they would be putting in.
All right, and, take it away. Okay.
You're only supposed to have sex when you make children.
Do you guys know anything about your vaginas?
Sister Mary Paul said that when it comes time to have sex with our husbands, he will know everything we need to know. Men don't like women who know too much about sex. It makes them seem like a slut. Your husband wants to know that you've waited faithfully for him.
Okay, now that's the most ridiculous thing I've heard yet.
I can't believe they didn't teach you that at Our Lady.
I mean, we learned that the church believes in abstinence and all, but it just wasn't that big of a deal. One girl did get kicked out my freshman year because she got pregnant, though.
Someone you went to high school with got pregnant?
Yeah.
Not married?
No, it was a total accident. The guy who knocked her up didn't even get kicked out of the school like she did, which was bull.
Did people at your school, like, have sex?
Oh, yeah, so many of them.
Well, this is why we are separated, because some people can't exercise self-control.
I can't believe you guys haven't gotten horny and fooled around with yourself a bit.
I don't even know where my vagina is. Like, I know where it is, but I've never touched it and been like, there it is.
That was a scene from O Righteous God and Sinful Me, read by Autumn Hemelgarn, Haley White, and playwright Lindsay Watkins. The play debuts this weekend in Raleigh as part of the Women's Theater Festival. So why put all of this on stage?
I really thought it was really important to... This is just in the second scene, and I wanted to say the word clitoris kind of early on because the reaction that people have to that word is so different than they do to hearing balls. And I thought that that was really interesting, like the stigma behind female genitalia and how, like, just randomly, like, freaked out people get when they hear about it. And, I mean, I didn't know anything about my own just female anatomy until I had to learn it for myself. And so someone like Evie, having someone like her to come in and tell them how things worked, I know that I would have thought that was important. And then I think that later on in my high school career, I got to become that person for some people. And I wanted to really highlight just a powerful woman who was also trying to empower other women through their own bodies.
I want to bring in one more guest to the conversation now, Alexandra Lightfoot. She's a professor of health behavior at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and she teaches college students how to use interactive theater as a tool to improve sexual education. Welcome, Alexandra.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So we've talked today about all kinds of ways sex ed is taking place or not in North Carolina schools. Tell us about using theater as a tool.
Okay, and I should say I'm a researcher who collaborates with different stakeholders around the state in collaboration with the UCLA Art and Global Health Center, who piloted the model that we're using here in North Carolina. And I just love that I'm coming on after this reading from, may I say how old you are? The playwright is 21 years old, and she's speaking to the issues that youth, young people are really, you know, grappling with around sex ed. You've heard about the importance from Julia and from Elizabeth and from Jamaica about why it's so important to address the issues of sex ed. And we've also heard Zach, who called in or wrote in or whatever, who said that he didn't really get sex ed. And all of us at this table actually have kind of talked about the fact that the sex ed that they received as young people wasn't adequate. So what can we do to ramp up how we deliver messages about sexual health, prevention of HIV and STIs, teen pregnancy, and all of that? So this model uses interactive theater as a way that it uses near peers, so college students, 21-year-olds and younger, who are close in age to the ninth graders who are supposed to be receiving, you know, the sex ed curriculum in public schools. They develop these scenarios that are dear to their hearts, what they wish they'd known, you know, when they were going through school. What did they not get? What do they need to know as they launch into young adulthood?
Can you give me a specific example?
Sure. Well, it's so funny. I mean, this play that you talk about, there's a scenario in the performance that we tested that had significant effects on increasing the knowledge of ninth grade students, where they're in an abstinence-only classroom, and the teacher's holding up anatomically correct pictures of female anatomy and male anatomy. And all she says is she hails up, "That's a vagina. Don't touch it. You know, that's a penis. That don't touch it." And they're students in the classroom sitting there with babies. So obviously, you know, they've had some experience. But that's really kind of the message that you get in school. And so interactive theater is this wonderful way of using humor, of using real stories, and also of practicing. That's the thing we were talking a little earlier, Lindsay and I, about the interactive theater approach, because you practice for real life. So you can stop the action. It makes you moves you from passive to active, and you can stop the action and say, what would I do in this situation?
So there are a number of techniques,
and
one of which you describe where you can kind of stop action and kind of break that wall and engage. Is this effective when it comes to behavior change, or what are students learning?
Absolutely. And in fact, you know, kind of it starts to affect attitudes and awareness, which are kind of the first steps to behavior change. And again, we've seen, you know, this kind of happen. We've piloted, I mean, or we've tested in both the Los Angeles Unified School District, and then in a school district here in North Carolina. And one of the things we're challenged to do now is to kind of look at the long-term effects. What happens, you know, between ninth grade and 12th grade? We heard earlier about the stats that in ninth grade, maybe 20% of North Carolinians are sexually active. By 12th grade, 58%. And we want to make sure that if they're sexually active, they are using protection. They understand the risks that present them. They're not using alcohol when they do this. So interactive theater is a way to bring in the stories of experience that slightly older peers have. It's also aligned with the state essential standards. So we make sure that all the pieces that we do align with the essential standards. It just enlivens the curriculum in a way that's very memorable.
Well, one of the things we've been talking about today, and we spoke with Jamika about, is representation. So the importance in Columbus County for students of color seeing her in front of their classroom, being the one to give them sex ed. What does representation do when you're using it in this theater kind of approach?
Hugely important. And of course, the students that it's set up as a class at universities. We've done it at UNC Chapel Hill, Duke, North Carolina Central, and we've just reached out to UNC Asheville as well. So we've got diverse students in the class bringing diverse voices, diverse experiences. You were asking about an example. For example, there's a technique. We do a three-line story. And it's about kind of what are the missed conversations that we have, a parent and a student, a pastor and someone in the congregation. In the performance that we did in a local school district, there were two Latinx young women having a conversation in Spanish. So that completely directly. Or we had two African-American males from North Carolina Central saying, "Whoa, I'm not ready to have sex, and I want my girlfriend, you know, to respect me on that." So that's like really twisting, you know, the story in really important ways so that people in classrooms can see themselves reflected. I was just looking at reminding myself about the research, a teacher saying that she saw what happened with students is they felt they were no longer alone. Other people like them were experiencing similar experiences. And
well, that's the thing I think that's been echoed throughout this conversation, which is that it's not, these conversations can be really uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. They can be uncomfortable for parents. They can be uncomfortable for kids. And it might not be that the kid wants to have sex. Maybe they want to learn how to say no. Maybe they want to learn how to engage in a more consensual relationship with their partner. And so having models that allow these various kinds of communication about sex or not sex at all, right, seems to be just as important as getting that biology lesson.
Exactly. So one of the scenarios was I'm proud to be a virgin. And we had several different people talking about why it was important to them. And it wasn't about the scare tactics about waiting for marriage necessarily, but it was about different aspects about that. So it complicates it really, I think, shares the complexity that we as young people or as a formerly young person face.
Yeah. Well, so we got an email from a listener who has had same-sex partners, and he says he wishes there were more teaching about same-sex sex in classrooms. How do you all incorporate conversations about LGBTQ relationships?
So again, so much of this is aligned with the state essential standards, but coming from the experiences of the people in the room. And so we have built a number of scenarios that have to do with same-sex relationships, with trying to talk to your parent about realizing your sexuality, that you are interested in same-sex partners. So again, we're building this curriculum to augment the state curriculum, and it has teacher guides. Actually, we'll have a parent guide, too. We're talking about the importance of engaging parents in this, but it also the range of sexuality. And it's very exciting to see where it'll go.
Haley, if you had seen something like this, I'm sorry, Lindsay. Lindsay, if you had seen something like your play as a high schooler, how do you think it would have changed your own trajectory?
I think that I would have been so shocked that this was allowed on stage, which is funny because it's just like this internalized idea that my sexuality and being a girl and having sexual feelings is wrong and is dirty, and just the narratives that have been written about our sexuality for us. I would have been shocked but also amazed, and I think that the best feeling would have been like, I relate to that. That makes sense to me. That's something that I feel too. And just hearing someone say, hey, this is normal, goes such a long way.
How about for you briefly, Autumn and Haley? The significance of seeing this kind of play when you were in high school, how would that have changed your own journey or experience?
I think it definitely would have helped because our wonderful playwright, Lindsay, includes my character, Faith, who is a lesbian and is going through this journey of discovering her sexuality and everything. And within a Catholic school, it is extremely hard to do that. So seeing that on stage, I think, would have been very helpful for me in high school as someone who also identifies as a lesbian.
Personally, I find it very important that kids all hear this kind of story because they're all learning about themselves. And I think one thing about my character, Evie, is I relate with her so much with how she is so willing to give all the information that she does know to her peers. However, she doesn't know that much herself. All she knows is based off what she's seen in media, like from different porns or magazines like Cosmo. So she is just knowing these things based off of that and not personal experience. So she's sharing these things with her peers. And I also was that kid growing up that was like, I don't know much, but what I do, I'll help out. And so I think it's really important for other kids to realize that it's okay to talk about it with each other as well and not just have it all into yourself and only be waiting for an adult to help you. You can talk to your friends too. And this whole show just really shows that you can have an open conversation with everyone.
Alexandra, in 10 seconds.
Okay, I was just going to say with accurate information, and that's, again, that we want to make sure that we convey. But the other thing you all were talking about is the other piece of research that we've done shows that it reduces stigma. Towards people living with HIV, towards non-gender conforming, all those kinds of things. And that's hugely important in our world.
Thank you so much to all of you for joining us. Alexandra Lightfoot is a faculty member at the Gillings School of Public Global Health at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Lindsay Watkins, a playwright. Actors Haley White and Autumn Hemelgarn. They will be on stage as part of the Women's Theater Festival and Rally this weekend. It kicks off tomorrow. All of the events are at our website, stateofthings.org. You can find more about the show, our guests, and everything we talked about today, and get a preview of our lineup. Next week, we'll continue our series on Embodied, talking about fertility and infertility. Stay with us. Join the conversation on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. That's the State of Things for today. I'm Anita Rao.